Hello and welcome to CSTW's Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Novelist Meg Wolitzer is the author of the New York Times notable book, The Wife, as well as The Position and This Is Your Life. Her current work is The 10-Year Nap, which chronicles the life of a group of New York City women who left careers to raise their children. Her short fiction has appeared in Best American Short Stories, and she lives in New York with her husband and sons. Welcome.
Thank you.
After a very long intro there.
Oh, the longer the better. You get to talk, I get to listen.
Now, you published your first novel right out of college.
Yes.
Have you always been a writer? Have you always written?
Oh, yeah. When I was really, really little, I have a mother who's a writer, and that really made all the difference. And, you know, she never said you have to go to law school. She always sort of said, yeah, you could be a writer, too. And I used to run home and write just the worst kind of things. You know, the first story that I remember writing was about two truckers, because I thought, oh, this was what adulthood was like. And it had dialogue in it, like, come on up on the rig, Mac, because I had heard the word rig. And I thought that this was the way truckers spoke. And this was what the world was about. And I was trying to imitate it. And I think that when you start writing, you really start by imitating what you hear.
Okay. How were you influenced by your mother's work as a writer? What kind of influence do you feel that exerted on yours?
I think the most important thing really was that I loved to read, that we had really good books in our house. You know, I would go down the block to a friend's house and it was like a Jacqueline Suzanne extravaganza, and there really weren't so-called literary novels in a lot of people's houses. But in my parents' house, there were really, really good books. And I read J.D. Salinger's Nine Stories when I was quite young. I remember reading it and reading the story Teddy, which was about a genius child, and loving the story and almost thinking it was for kids. And even in A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, there's a young child, too, and really responding to these things when I was very young. And I think that that had an enormous influence on me.
Okay. Now, you and your husband both are both writers.
Yes.
And you have offices at home. Is that how it works?
Well, let's just say if you call a bed an office, yes, I do. We live in an apartment in Manhattan, a 3-bedroom apartment, and 2 of those rooms belong to our kids. And my husband sort of takes up the desk in the bedroom, which leaves me with various beds because I prefer that. I have, a laptop, and I really kind of like moving around when I write. I'm not somebody who actually works well at a desk looking out upon a field.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to follow up on that. What is your writing process? How do you sit down and you decide what you're going to write? Do you have set times of the day, set blocks that you have to work on?
I think having kids has been an enormous help to me, actually, rather than a hindrance. I mean, people talk about, oh, should I have kids? Would my work work out okay? But for me, it's like nap time meant there was a gun to my head and I had to work. And school time meant that there was a gun to my head, but it was longer
It
was an 8-hour gun. And before I had kids, I think I thought I was immortal. And, you know, I remember watching the Game Show Network during the day. And boy, I must have really thought I was immortal back then doing that. Because now, I mean, it's not that you can't have fun or goof off. You absolutely can. But I really do use the time that's available to me well. I like to work. I love to work. So I kind of keep banker's hours or school teacher hours and work during the day, and probably don't work that much when my kids are around in the evening. But I'm also a real insomniac, and I will work in the night if I get up. Absolutely.
Do your children read your books? Have they read your books? I'm curious because you wrote a book called The Position about a couple that publishes a sort of joy of sex manual, and then their children come upon it after publication, and it alters their lives. That's not based on personal experience, but I'm curious how that whether they have been reading your stuff as they get older.
I tell them I'm a travel agent. Children seem to be narcissists in that they are far less interested, I think, in us than we worry that they will be. Mm-hmm. My older son read a couple of my books. The novel, The Position, which, as you say, is about 4 siblings whose parents have written this kind of joy of sex book back in the 1970s, and it's what happens to the kids when they grow up. It's really about the intersection of sex and family and how there's this sort of awkwardness about it all. And I think that for me, it's not about being a writer. I mean, I think that whatever you do as a parent is slightly embarrassing to your kids if you talk too loud or funny. So I think that there's always going to be that. And I remember when my mother wrote her first novel, and it had actually a sex scene in it, and I came to school, and these two kind of dumb boys at school had, you know, hey, turn to page 83, and were laughing. But to my mind, thinking about that now, boy, what a literary culture that was. I can't really quite see that happening right now, turn to page 83, you know. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much other media that has sort of taken over, that books are just kind of part of a big tide. I think my kids are proud of me. Probably if they read my books more thoroughly, they would also feel embarrassed. But I have the great Wonder Woman shield against all of those kinds of questions, which is that they're novels. They are novels. They're made up. They're not me telling the story of my, you know, porn years. You know, they're completely made up, and I think they respect the idea of the imagination because of it.
Mm-hmm. And so that it's something I've often wondered about novelists. There's never been a time when you recognized that you were telling somebody else's story. You heard third hand the Truman Capote line, you know, what are writers doing around wealthy people? They're taking notes.
Right.
And that doesn't enter into it for you? You're...
Very little, actually. Uh-huh. I wouldn't. If I were to appear in somebody else's book, it would be upsetting. And I think if somebody else found themselves in my book, I think it would be upsetting to them. But above and beyond that, it's not that I'm cannibalizing people's lives. What I take from the world, I think, I take some of my own experiences, but very few, mostly little scenic moments. But I think I'm trying to take something sort of larger than just the story of somebody or a character whole cloth. Where's the fun? Where's the fun in doing that? I mean, if you're Truman Capote, I can see that the fun could be there because he was a great mimic and he was a great caricaturist. Mm-hmm. But I really sort of like the idea of saying, I'm going to sort of start from scratch.
Okay. When you do that, how do you feel, what part of it is it for you that you recognize that a character feels true to you if it's not like Capote based on somebody? What moments do you have? How do you develop a character? Because, I mean, I've written some stuff that we'll not talk about.
We will.
Because it's terrible. and it's never been published. But that's one of the things that I've tried to figure out as writing fiction. How do you write characters that that you're satisfied with?
Well, one thing, when I was writing The 10-Year Nap, I set a sort of goal for myself, which was that none of the main characters would have a job. And in doing that, they all were therefore somewhat passive in some way. And you have to sort of create characters who can be somewhat passive without making the writing seem passive, because that would be the imitative fallacy, the fallacy of imitative form. And how do you do that? For me, a very important key is in dialogue. And you say the dialogue out loud to yourself. And I think not to be afraid of actually letting people talk and letting them kind of go on for a while. Mm-hmm. That's something that I didn't used to do. I used to sort of suggest. And my friends would tease me because not only did I suggest dialogue, but I sort of suggested scenes. I never had an actual scene before going into the past. Suddenly, you know, we'd have a scene where people are emptying the dishwasher and suddenly it's 1974 and they're at camp. And why couldn't I tolerate leaving them in the kitchen in the dishwasher? Why couldn't I tolerate having them talk to each other the way people really talk to each other? So I tried to do that much more with this book. And I think that character can bloom out of the way people interact with each other. One exercise that I've always had students do when I've taught has been to sort of eavesdrop on a couple of people at a table in a restaurant and try to infer what their relationship is with each other. Because students in a story will sort of give away the store, will say, "Mother, I don't want to go back to college," you know, rather than speaking in a sort of churlish way that a semi-adult son might to his mother. Mm-hmm. And I think that the interactions really brings out character. And from there, you kind of, what you get, it's like a scavenger hunt. You find a clue to something else about the character, and then you find something else.
Okay. Who are you currently watching in fiction? Who are your favorites to read right now?
Lori Moore, who's a writer I like a lot and a friend, is, I think, wonderful, and she has a new novel coming out. Mary Gordon is also, again, I sort of, there is kind of a crowd of, you know, women fiction writers today, mm-hmm. a lot of whom I really, really admire. Jane Smiley, somebody whose books are all really different from one another. You know, I was just, since his death, I was rereading some David Foster Wallace and just a lot of different things. I like to read Philip Roth, actually. Mm. And I think that he's been an example of a kind of muscular writer who's sort of excited me when I'm writing.
Okay. I'd like to read a couple things that I, moments that I really loved in this sure. latest book. There's a passage about a young Oklahoma woman on her way to have an abortion, and it goes like this. Her life was small and its edges well-defined, and then suddenly becoming pregnant had made it both finite and less certain. And now she was relying on a stranger to drive her across the state so she could be an ordinary teenage girl, so she could be returned to herself. And I thought that was a great description there.
Thanks.
Now, you may not recall that exact line, but I'm curious, how do you feel at the end of day having written about difficult territory like that?
If I didn't write about difficult territory, I think I would be bored and angry with myself in some way. Mm-hmm. Because I realized, I mean, I like these three books, what I consider almost like a suite of books, The 10-Year Nap, The Wife, and The Position. Or The 10-Year Nap, The Position, and The Wife, going backwards. I like them a lot more than I like any of my earlier books. I don't really like thinking about my earlier books because I think that with these three books, I sort of tried to kind of capture a cultural moment in each one. Mm-hmm. And it therefore connected me to the world. And I thought, what are you writing about if not the things that you feel are important? Why do it? And if you're going to be kind of meek when you write, you have to ask yourself why. I mean, who are you hiding from? And finally, the big question, I think, which is, if not now, when? You know, I mean, I think for some writers and some women, or at least for me, there's the good girl complex, which is always a problem, which is you start out in life, you know, being a student teachers like, and you want to mm-hmm. please them. And your writing starts out being something that sort of pleases a certain person who you have in mind. And that can get you a long way. But finally, when you can stop doing that, I think it gets you further.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Humor plays a large part in your stories. You describe a well-run European-style dinner party as one in which, quote, nobody had tried to hump the leg of somebody with slightly more power. And that made me laugh out loud when I read that. What is it that makes humor work for you in a story?
It has to arise naturally. It's not about one-liners. When I hear myself described sometimes as, you know, a humorist, I'm surprised. I'm taken aback because it has mm-hmm. to be kind of seamless. It can't be there for the sake of itself. If there's a joke that's really funny, but it stands out in, you know, it's set in relief, it's got to go. It's got to go. There was a line, a Grace Paley line about the myth of the best love sentence, pluck it out. I think that's really true of jokes in fiction. And yet fiction without wit is often, to my thinking, sort of dead, because it's as if the writer feels, depending on the book, of course. I mean, certain books like Coetzee's Disgrace, you know, we would never think of, there's nothing funny in that book and it doesn't belong there. But if a writer is keeping the wit out deliberately to seem serious, mm-hmm. I have to ask, what is it about funny that you think is less important? Because isn't our situation funny? Isn't our situation sad and funny? And that's sort of the way I approach it.
So have there been specific times when you've had to take things out like that? Is that's part of the revision process?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, there'll be something that I always liked and always thought that it was the sort of centerpiece of, you know, or the anchor of a scene. But in fact, it was just there. The rest of the writing was there as a vessel to get to the joke. And that's glib. That doesn't belong in a novel, as far as I'm concerned.
So when you're writing, you're thinking in terms of scenes, or how does when you sit down? I've been curious about anybody that writes a novel because I've only ever written short fiction, because you
right.
can do that fairly quickly. Did you proceed chronologically through this? What was your take on it? There were certain scenes that you wrote, and when I wrote my dissertation, which we also shall not speak of, I said to my wife that it was a process of accretion. It
yeah.
just built over time to be, you know, this whatever it was. And I'm curious how that works for you in writing.
I do start with an idea as opposed to a character or a scene or a sentence. Mm-hmm. I start with an idea, a kind of puzzle that I want to sort of solve in a way. And in the case of The 10-Year Nap, it was really, What is it like for women who stop working, smart, educated women who've been ambitious previously? What is it like for them when they stay home with their children? Rather than taking a stand on it, what is it like? Just show what it's like. That was my place to do that. And yeah, it is a process of accretion. I think that something that happens to young writers is that they like their language and they hone their language and they kind of whittle it like a piece of soap until they're kind of getting less rather than more. They're editing while they're writing. I'm all for just getting volume. I think volume really matters. I think that even if it's really kind of crappy, if you have a first draft and it's a lot of pages and it's in front of you, you have something to work with and you can step back and look at it and say, this is not what I meant. This is not what I meant to do. Now I can take it and shape it and change it and throw out half of it. But I think getting it down is something that's been kind of undervalued, but I'm all for it.
That's great advice. Have you thrown away half of it something?
Oh, absolutely. I've thrown away a lot. But again, it's sort of like, you know, chicken bones. You don't really throw it away. You can take lines from it. I have something on my desktop of my computer, a stickies that's filled with lines and titles and character names that I have not used because they were from something that I didn't, you know, that I sort of was experimenting with and didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. But I like them, and there they are. And it's sort of like one day they'll pop up like a number in a bingo tumbler, and I'll be ready for them.
Okay. One of the things that I like to do is do it like I've stole this from the writers, from the actor studio.
Does this involve me being blindfolded and going on a trust walk with you?
Yes, it is. You're going to have to fall backwards and trust
into the arms of.
That's why we have all these padding behind you.
Right.
Actually, they're just short answers.
Sure.
So what other kinds of writing haven't you done that you'd like to try?
Plays, definitely.
Plays?
Yeah, I'd love to do that.
Okay. No fantasy novels, no swords and sorcerers.
No.
What's the best part of being a writer?
Finishing a book you like and then walking around in this kind of cocky way for one day until you realize what's wrong with it. But what feel that excitement of finishing something, staying up all night to finish something and actually finishing it feels thrilling.
Okay. What's the worst part about being a writer?
It feels sometimes... being a fiction writer, that you're doing something very obscure, like you're doing scrimshaw or working on a hand loom, because we live in a really nonfiction world. We live in a world that is now run by the 24-hour news cycle. And I think people are frightened of what's happened in their lives and what's happened in the world, and they want information. And they have come to see that or think that they can get information much more readily from nonfiction than they can from fiction. And I think it's the place of novelists and short story writers to make the case for fiction, that fiction is essential to our lives. Because really, if you look back, say, on fiction that came out in the 70s and 80s, a lot of really important and wonderful new voices were heard. Say in the 70s, Toni Morrison, Louise Erdrich, Ann Beattie. And these were stories of people's lives that we hadn't heard before. And a society that doesn't want to learn about different lives is a society without empathy. So I think that making the case for fiction is really important. And I know this is supposed to be a short answer, so I'll stop.
Okay. What is the best writing job you've had? It's okay to say the current one.
Well, actually, writing my novel, The Position, was maybe the best writing job I've had because I was talking about it to a friend. I wrote it really quickly. I wrote it more quickly than anything I'd ever written. Mm-hmm. It was as though I was my own secretary typing down something that was already fully formed in my head. It went so fast, and that was very exciting.
What's the worst job you had that prepared you for being a writer? David Mamet wrote for Playboy is the one that always comes to mind because he wrote in the letters section and he had to come up with the letters. And I've always thought that was a very funny story, but also, you know, like one of the worst jobs to have,
right,
but
right.
Prepared him.
I was in a toy think tank briefly when I was a young writer, and we were hired by a toy company, a bunch of us who were all writers, to go away to a hotel for a week and brainstorm ideas for toys. And I came up with this elaborate toy, the doll, and I was so excited by it. I had a whole thing in my head called, they were going to be called Sleepaway Pals, and girls would bring them to sleepaway camp, and they would be a little doll in a sleeping bag, but you'd turn it inside out and it would become a purse. And I had a whole narrative. I named them. They were, you know, characters. And then we had to pitch them to the toy people. And I was done pitching them, and they said, good, good. But what about if they were Gorgons in space? I mean, you know, they completely threw out everything that I had that was sort of sweet about it and wanted to make it something violent and ugly. And I think that prepared me that the world wants something violent and ugly, but you've got to hang on to what you want to do.
Who was your biggest influence as a writer? Not necessarily who you like, but who you feel maybe looking over your shoulder or responding to.
Well, I would actually say Philip Roth is somebody, again, who has just not cared what people have thought. And I think I have a lot of mixed feelings about his work. Some of his novels really are, you know, there's been problems with women in his novels. The women characters are as thin as a broth, you know, but he's a muscular writer and he just doesn't care what people think, it seems to me. And he's very prolific. And all of that are things that I admire and I would love to have.
Okay. Well, Meg Wallitzer, I want to thank you very much
for
coming and talking to us today. And I hope you're enjoying your stay in Columbus, however long it is, 24 hours, and then go back to New York.
Oh, thank you.